Hi, and welcome to Touching the Future. I'm your Sun Sounds volunteer, Chip Hobrock. First on this week's program, an article from space.com. This is actually from the column Space Insider by Leonard David. Are the aliens us? UFOs may be piloted by time-traveling humans, book argues. The great distances covered by visiting aliens may be ones of time rather than space, a recent book argues. This was posted on January 20th. Unidentified flying objects, or UFOs, have captured the public's attention over the decades. As exoplanet detection is on the rise, why not consider that star-hopping visitors from afar might be buzzing through our friendly skies after taking an interstellar off-ramp to Earth? On the other hand, could those piloting UFOs be us, our future progeny that have mastered the landscape of time and space? Perhaps those reports of people coming into contact with strange beings represent our distant human descendants returning from the future to study us in their own evolutionary past. The idea of us being them has been advanced before, but a recent book, Identified Flying Objects, a Multidisciplinary Scientific Approach to the UFO Phenomenon, takes a fresh look at this prospect, offering some thought-provoking proposals. Multidisciplinary Approach. The book was written by Michael Masters, a professor of biological anthropology at Montana Technical University in Butte. Masters thinks that, given the accelerating pace of change in science, technology, and engineering, it's likely that humans of the distant future could develop the knowledge and machinery necessary to return to the past. The objective of the book, Masters said, is to spur a new and more informed discussion among believers and skeptics alike. I took a multidisciplinary approach in order to try and understand the oddities of this phenomenon, Masters told Space.com. Our job as scientists is to be asking big questions and try to find answers to unknown questions. There's something going on here, and we should be having a conversation about this. We should be at the forefront of trying to find out what it is. Human evolution. Dubbing these purported visitors extratempestrials, Masters notes that close encounter accounts typically describe UFO tenants as bipedal, hairless, human-like beings with large brains, large eyes, small noses, and small mouths. Further, the creatures are often said to have the ability to communicate with us in our own languages and possess technology advanced beyond, but clearly built upon, today's technological prowess. Masters believes that through a comprehensive analysis of consistent patterns of long-term biocultural change throughout human evolution, as well as recent advances in our understanding of time and time travel, we may begin to consider this future possibility in the context of a currently unexplained phenomenon. The book ties together those known aspects of our evolutionary history with what is still an unproven, unverified aspect of UFOs and aliens, he said. But why not argue that E.T. is actually a traveler from across the vastness of space from a distant planet? Wouldn't that be a simpler answer? I would argue it's the opposite, Masters responded. We know we're here. We know humans exist. We know that we've had a long evolutionary history on this planet. And we know our technology is going to be more advanced in the future. I think the simplest explanation, innately, is that it is us. I'm just trying to offer what is likely the most parsimonious explanation. Archaeological tourism. As an anthropologist who has worked on and directed numerous archaeological digs in Africa, France, and throughout the United States, Masters observes that it is easy to conceptualize just how much more could be learned about our own evolutionary history if we currently possessed the technology to visit vast and past periods of time. The alleged abduction accounts are mostly scientific in nature. It's probably future anthropologists, historians, linguists that are coming back to get information in a way that we currently can't without access to that technology, Master said. That said, I do think that some component of it is also tourism, he added. Undoubtedly, in the future, there are those that will pay a lot of money to have the opportunity to go back and observe their favorite period in history. Some of the most popular tourist sites are the pyramids of Giza and Machu Picchu in Peru, old and prehistoric sites. Masters calls his UFO research an evolving project. There's certainly still missing pieces of the puzzle, he said. There are aspects of time that we don't understand yet. Wanted is a theory of quantum gravity, and we can meld general relativity and quantum mechanics. I'm just trying to put forth the best model I can based on current scientific knowledge. Hopefully, over time, we can continue to build on this. Solve this mystery. Masters postulates that using a multidisciplinary scientific approach to the UFO phenomenon will be what it takes to solve the mystery once and for all. And I couldn't agree more, said Jan Harzen, executive director of the nonprofit Mutual UFO Network, or MUFON. The premise that UFOs are us from the future is one of many possibilities the MUFON is exploring to explain the UFO phenomenon. All we know for sure is that we are not alone, Harzen added. Now the question becomes, who are they? And Masters makes a great case for the time traveler hypothesis. Highly dubious claim. But not everybody is on board with the idea, as you might imagine. There is nothing in this book to take seriously, as it depends on the belief that time travel is not only possible, but real, said Robert Schaefer, a noted UFO skeptic. Supposedly, our distant descendants have mastered time travel, Schaefer said, and have traveled back in time to visit us. So, according to Masters, you just spin something fast enough, and it will begin to warp space and even send stuff backwards in time. This is a highly dubious claim, he said. Moreover, Schaefer said that Masters tries to deduce aliens' evolutionary history from witness descriptions, suggesting that he takes such accounts far too literally. The problem of if. David Darling is a British astronomer and science writer who has authored books on a sweeping array of topics, from gravity, Zen physics, and astrobiology, to teleportation and extraterrestrial life. I've often thought that if some UFOs are alien craft, it's just as reasonable to suppose that they might be time machines from our own future than that they're spacecraft from other stars, Darling told Space.com. The problem is the if. Darling said that while some aerial phenomena have eluded easy identification, one of the least likely explanations, it seems to him, is that they're artificial and not of this world. Outside of the popular mythos of flying saucers and archetypal big-brained aliens, there's precious little credible evidence that they exist, Darling said. So my issue with the book is not the ingenuity of its thesis, but the fact that there's really no need for such a thesis in the first place. Exotic physics. Larry Lemke, a retired NASA aerospace engineer with an interest in the UFO phenomenon, finds the prospect of time-traveling visitors from the future intriguing. The one thing that has become clear over the decades of sightings, if you believe the reports, is that these objects don't seem to be obeying the usual laws of aerodynamics and Newtonian mechanics, Lemke said, referring to the relationship in the natural world between force, mass, and motion. Toss in, for good measure, Einstein's theory of general relativity and its consequences, like wormholes and black holes, along with other exotic physics ideas such as the Alcubierre warp drive bubble. There's a group of thinkers in the field of USOs that point out that phenomena reported around some UFOs do, in fact, look exactly like general relativity effects, Lemke said. Missing time is a very common one. Lemke said that the idea that somebody has figured out how to manipulate space-time on a local scale with a low-energy approach would explain a lot of things across the UFO phenomenon, including those baffling tic-tac-shaped objects recently reported by jet fighter pilots and radar operators. No matter how much knowledge we have, how much we think we know, there's always some frontier beyond, he said, and to understand that frontier is getting more and more esoteric. Let's move on now to another article, this one from Forbes.com. Davos announces that the highest growth careers are in STEM, with a caveat. This article was posted on January 25th and was written by Anna Powers. Davos is a town in Switzerland which became synonymous with the yearly high-profile event it hosts, the World Economic Forum. In this event, business leaders, heads of state, and activists all gather to talk about pressing world issues relating to the economy, business, and the environment. This year, the World Economic Forum, in conjunction with several other research partners, put out a research report about careers of the future in the global economy based on key data sources. There are several findings of the report. One of them is that careers in STEM are projected to be the highest growing in the coming few years. Of course, this may not surprise many of us due to the fact, as I've written in the past, that the proliferation of STEM has changed and revolutionized our world. The striking factor of the report was that it wasn't all about the data-driven skills, but rather the combination of data skills with the human element, which was said to be the golden ticket. The report focused on what it dubbed seven professional clusters or career groupings that were found to be key for the future. The seven are care professionals, data and AI, engineering and cloud computing, green professions, marketing, sales and content, people and culture, and product development. According to the report, these new clusters will provide 1.7 million jobs in 2020 and 2.4 million in 2022. These jobs will require skills that are both technical, such as tech baseline skills and tech disruption skills, coupled with business savvy skills, such as general business knowledge, sector expertise, and soft skills. The high volume jobs will be found in artificial intelligence, data science, and engineering, but they will span all seven professional clusters. Data and AI, as well as engineering and cloud computing clusters, are said to be the fastest growing among 20 economies, while in the U.S., the green economy cluster is predicted to have the fastest growth but lowest number of absolute job openings for 2020 to 2022. If we look at the findings of the report and consider them as they fit within the innovation within our society, we will see that there is only one way for science to advance our society, and that is through humanistic attributes, which allow us to share the beauty of science and its potential with others around us. As I've written many times in the past, science is inherently creative and imaginative. All innovation in science comes from imagination. Once something can be imagined, it can then be created, using the elements of science to bring it to life in tangible form. As a matter of fact, many of the world's innovators spoke about this inherent creativity. Nikola Tesla once said, "Invention is the most important product of man's creative brain." Thus, combining scientific skills with business acumen and soft skills will enable future scientific innovators to understand how to implement science in society so as to solve the world's problems more efficiently by seeing how the pieces of the puzzle fall together. The more we're able to communicate science, making it understandable for large numbers of people, the more science will fuse deeply with society and transform it to be more progressive and advanced. The key lies in creativity, in learning and understanding how the principles of science can be used to change the world. That is only possible when we have an understanding of what the world needs, and that can only happen through effective communication and collaboration, both skill sets necessary for the jobs of the future. Here's an article from the Fort Myers, Florida News Press. Vanderbilt scientists tagged by U.S. Geological Survey to forecast future water needs. The writer's name is Chad Gillis, and this was posted on January 24th. Scientists and lawmakers need more data and information on water use in the United States to better paint a forecast of what water availability and demand will look like in 25 years. That was one message from George Hornberger, a Vanderbilt University professor and chairman of the school's Institute for Energy and the Environment. He spoke Friday in front of more than 100 scientists, agency experts, and advocacy groups at a forum called the Southwest Florida Water Resources Conference, now in its 29th year, at Florida Gulf Course at Florida Gulf Coast University. Looking 25 years into the future is not the easiest thing to do, Hornberger told the group. I often think about it that if we look back at what predictions were made and look at what transpired 25 years later, those ideas quickly become outdated, and much quicker than in 25 years. Hornberger was one of a group of scientists who put together a water mapping strategy for the United States Geological Survey. The scientists were tasked with developing ideas on how to combat water quality and quantity changes, some of which don't even exist yet. We've seen tremendous advances over the past couple of decades, and a lot of this is due to our ability to assimilate and collect data and really use some of the high-power technical computing, Hornberger said. So it does provide a context to look into the future. The group also wanted to know how humans impact water quality and quantity. Answering the questions, he said, will take more work. The nation also needs to develop a new type of worker, people who are able to understand the complex problems and carry out complicated solutions. We need to really look to build a workforce that understands these new things, he said. It would be near and dear to my heart for them to hire only geologists and hydrologists, but we all need to recognize that it's more than just hydrology. From there, the USGS will need to deal with how to properly inform the public while also working with existing government agencies that have control over where water goes and to what degree it gets treated. We don't have enough difficulty with just the social and physical sciences, but now we have to figure out how institutions and government agencies even interact and how we might improve water resource management, Hornberger said. Climate change will bring about weather patterns that haven't been imagined, and flooding and other natural disasters will increase the amount of pollution in the water and increase the spread of certain diseases. It's not just spread of disease due to flooding or the introduction of exotic chemicals into our water supply, but there are lots of connections between water quality and health, Hornberger said. His group has lots of science, but little political influence. They're not a regulatory agency, but more of a committee designed to study future water health issues. How do you get an agency to collaborate without a carrot or a stick, Hornberger said. I think we've made good progress and with a lot of these agencies. They really do care. They want to be hopeful that we're going to solve these problems and not just point to the fear. FGCU professor and researcher Wynne Everham facilitated the second panel of the day and said the conference is a meeting place for water resource experts and others concerned about future supply. Our scientists and faculty are stepping beyond these discipline boundaries and getting involved in the community and politics to move these issues forward. And I think that's a cool message that came from today, Everham said. It's always been a place to bring water resource professionals together and get everyone up to speed on the issues. Next, we have an article from the website of Science Magazine, that's sciencemag.org. Learning from the past and considering the future of chemicals in the environment. The authors are Andrew C. Johnson, Xiaowei Jin, Norihide Nakata, and John P. Sumpter. Their article was posted on the 24th of January. Synthetic chemicals have enabled market improvements in food production and living standards. Although concerns exist about the many hundreds of chemicals in the environment, there are only a few, albeit notable, examples of chemicals actually harming wildlife populations. These examples demonstrate that hydrophobic chemicals can both persist in the environment and bioconcentrate, meaning that the highest exposures manifest in the longest-lived top predators. In addition, tests of acute toxicity on a limited range of laboratory-friendly species are not predictive for all species and effects, and chronic tests on a wider range of organisms are needed. Knowledge gained from such disasters should make the use of chemicals increasingly safer. However, our past failure suggests that we must be prepared for more surprises in the future. Proportion of chemicals for which adequate environmental information is known. In places where data are accessible, such as the United States and Europe, the number of chemicals and substances on the market is believed to be around 75,000 to 140,000. However, empirical data on persistence are available for about 0.2%, bioconcentration data for 1%, and aquatic toxicity for 11% of chemicals registered in the European Union. And similar data have been reported for the United States. In the absence of such substantive information for the majority of chemicals, computational predictive methods can provide some help in terms of risk assessment. Nevertheless, the task is complicated by the formation of breakdown products in the environment, for which we have little to no information. An additional challenge to our efforts to assess risks from these many chemicals entering the environment is the potential for mixture events. These effects may lead to higher impacts on organisms than would have been predicted on the basis of individual chemical-based risk assessments. Today's research funding model tends to encourage widening and deepening studies on the current chemicals or group of chemicals perceived to be of most concern, rather than supporting research on a larger proportion of the chemicals being discharged and considered potentially problematic. Chemical risks are not equal, nor is exposure. Given the vast array of chemicals contaminating our natural environment, where should we focus our greatest attention? For instance, the risk of copper harming wildlife is reported to be 5 orders of magnitude higher than the risk from the drug atenol, when comparing median exposure with median toxicity values for rivers in the United Kingdom. In other words, the risk of harm from atenol is only 0.001% of the risk from copper. In fact, metals dominate the top 10 of 71 chemicals of concern studied in the United Kingdom and are similarly highly ranked in China. Chemical exposure from wastewater, which can be expressed as the extent to which the wastewater generated by an individual will be diluted by the natural water flow, is not evenly spread around the world. Depending on landmass, population size, and rainfall amount, some countries will face constant and widespread elevated exposure to chemicals and wastewater, whereas other nations will experience much less exposure. New chemicals and new places of concern. In modern society, chemicals are expected to serve a variety of functions. Examples include medicines, flame retardants, and pesticides. We now recognize that the very properties that can make these chemicals work effectively can simultaneously be deleterious for the wider environment. For instance, as medical knowledge grows, the expectation for new pharmaceutical-based treatments for diverse health conditions will continue. A current example is the incentive for drug companies to devise more effective compounds to treat a range of age-related conditions. Additionally, ethanol estradiol has been a very effective oral contraceptive, but the combination of its potency and persistence has made it an endocrine disruptor in wild fish downstream of wastewater effluent. If some of the new pharmaceuticals act as agonists or antagonists on the endocrine system, then the estrogen-based disruption may expand to a wider variety of fish. On the subject of flame retardants, problems with certain compounds have led to a wider range of replacement candidate substances, including non-halogenated organic or metal compounds with phosphate groups, hydroxide or stannate groups. Finally, concerns over pesticide mobility, non-target toxicity, and persistence have markedly reduced the number of products for sale. The pest control approaches of tomorrow are likely to be more precisely targeted to affect RNA interference, pheromones, and sterility. New flame retardants and insecticides should be much safer than old ones, but we must be alert to unexpected consequences, as have been observed, for insect-specific postsynaptic agonists. These compounds, once considered sustainable, are now known to cause population decline in wild bees. The modern economy has been transformed by globalization. As a result, much chemical production has been transferred to Asia, where chemical sales are now 161% of those in the United States and Europe combined. However, in some cases, weak regulation or uneven local enforcement has led to severe pollution hotspots. Examples include atmospheric contamination with chlorofluorocarbons coming from the Shandong and Hebei provinces of China, gross perfluorooctanoic acid pollution from a vast Chinese manufacturing site, and water contamination with antibiotics from a manufacturing plant in India. Unfortunately, successful management of industrial waste and pollution more generally is far from straightforward. Setting water quality targets is a good step, but such benchmarks are successful only where independent regulators take consistent, high-quality measurements and are supported by an independent judiciary on both the local and national scale. The degree to which environmental protection is improved by centralization or when it is devolved to local administrations is debatable. In the case of local governance in China, there is evidence for uneven application of regulations. Protection is also boosted by a national commitment to transparency, in which scrutiny by the public, environmental, non-governmental organizations, and journalists is accepted. Nevertheless, this approach has not been adopted globally. Reasons for optimism. Progress in regulation and management of chemicals in the environment. Chemical regulations in the 1960s and 1970s concentrated on remediating past pollution and controlling the emission of a limited number of pollutants. The approach today is becoming forward-looking to ensure that new chemicals poised to enter the market will conform to minimum human safety and environmental standards. Examples like the Toxic Substance Control Act, TSCA, in 1976 in the United States, as well as Registration, Evaluation, Authorization, and Restriction of Chemicals, or REACH, in the European Union. Still, because many chemicals entered the market before these laws were enacted, a retrospective authorization process is trying to catch up. Although not perfect, the establishment of regulations such as TSCA and REACH set an important precedent. The onus to demonstrate that a chemical is safe for humans and the environment should lie with the manufacturer. In Europe, the phrase used to describe this concept is no data, no market. Analytical developments, knowledge of undesirable chemical characteristics, and alternatives to animal testing. Developments in analytical chemistry continue to drive down limits of detection. With the use of non-targeted screening, NTS methods, it is becoming possible to search for and tentatively identify all molecules present in a sample, both known and unknown. NTS has been applied to reveal the range of compounds in urban runoff water, to investigate unusual pollution incidents, and to identify the industrial premises responsible for such incidents. Recently, historic analytical raw data from previous studies have been used to retrospectively analyze new pollutants that were not originally targeted in these studies. These new approaches will help make the environment more transparent with respect to chemical contaminants. There is now much shared knowledge on the undesirability of properties such as hydrophobicity and persistence in chemicals intended for discharge to the environment. In the consumer goods industry, recognition of poor biodegradability has led to the replacement of certain compounds. Although not driven primarily by environmental concerns, an increasing proportion of newly registered pharmaceuticals are the so-called biologics. For example, 12 of the 30 new drugs registered for the German market in 2016 and 75 of the 200 recent top-selling retail drugs in the United States are made from biological materials, such as proteins, genes, allergens, and cells. These substances are not considered to pose the persistence issues of small synthetic molecules. Understandably, ethical concerns have arisen about subjecting large numbers of animals to laboratory toxicity tests for the many thousands of chemicals yet to be registered, and these concerns have encouraged the development of toxicity and exposure models. Computer models have been used to help detect and predict which chemicals will be of greatest concern in silico risk assessment. In other words, these will be persistent, bioaccumulative, and toxic, PBT. In a survey of 95,000 chemicals, a model predicted that only 3 to 5% were likely to be PBT. Better wastewater treatment and international chemical initiatives. Shifting from primary wastewater treatment, settling, to secondary treatment, biological, and increasing biological treatment time in secondary treatment from simple methods such as trickling filters to activated sludge have considerable benefits for general water quality and chemicals reduction. The widespread adoption of the activated sludge process, or ASP, in towns and cities around the world, with a biological treatment time of 8 hours or more, has done a great deal to protect rivers from the worst consequences of high chemical exposures. In China, it's now reported that the water distributed to 94% of urban population receives wastewater treatment, with 81% undergoing advanced processes such as ASP. Introduction of these methods can substantially improve water quality and hence biodiversity as compared with previous, less efficient treatments. As a society, we now have the capacity to introduce stringent tertiary treatment to eliminate most all organics from wastewater effluent, as is being done in some parts of Switzerland. Developed and developing countries share many of the same chemical challenges. This is particularly true with regard to many persistent pollutants with no known boundaries. It's encouraging to see international agreements on persistent organic pollutants, Stockholm Convention, Mercury, Minamata Convention, Hazardous Waste Disposal, Basel Convention, and Certain Hazardous Chemicals and Pesticides, Rotterdam Convention. Sensible advice on managing chemicals with respect to legal, economic, technical, and voluntary instruments, and the adoption of safer alternatives is now available to all countries. Reasons for pessimism. Continuing uncertainty over the importance of non-lethal effects. Once we move away from apical endpoints, that is, lethal or endpoints that disrupt reproduction or growth, it remains a matter of speculation as to whether the response to a chemical observed in the laboratory really translates to harm for individuals or populations in the wild. In theory, the detected mechanistic detection of an adverse outcome pathway, AOP, predicts harmful effects ranging from the molecular level up to the population level. AOPs have been used to confidently predict population effects on fish from endocrine disruptors, yet these effects have not been observed in the field. Whether the development of AOPs will aid in the environment risk and assessment of chemicals is presently unclear. Similarly, the question of whether gene, protein, or metabolite expression studies can, on their own, predict actual impacts on wildlife populations or food webs remains to be answered. Data quality and the relevance of research topics. It is now widely accepted that a high proportion of published research is not reproducible, a situation sometimes called the reproducibility crisis. Reasons may include perverse incentives on scientists to publish exciting research, and a general lack of training for researchers. Two common associated problems are poor experimental design and bias. In ecotoxicology, many scientists conduct their research on animals that are not routinely used in regulatory tests and other researchers rarely use. The focus of public concern over chemicals is unpredictable. This can lead to sudden demands for information, which can overwhelm other research areas. Inevitably, many fundable topics will have to be dropped so that resources can be concentrated in an area of new concern. One area of marked growth has been the study of nanoparticles and the environment. A search for this topic on Web of Science revealed an increase of 36 papers per year in 2000 to 4,200 per year in 2017. Yet, many studies appear to show a modest relative risk, at least for common metal-based nanoparticles. Another example may be the study of bisphenol A, or BPA, an additive used in many plastic items, which has been shown to exhibit weak estrogen activity. Many hundreds of studies on BPA's presence and possible harm to the environment have been published. A September 2019 search of Web of Science with the terms BPA effect and environment revealed 630 papers. Yet the evidence that BPA is adversely affecting wildlife is essentially non-existent. On the other hand, there are many thyroid activity, cardiovascular, anti-epileptic, and muscle relaxant drugs for which few, if any, studies of possible effects on aquatic wildlife have been carried out. Perhaps surprisingly, the focus of research into chemicals in the environment is not necessarily linked to their relative risk. For the top 20 highest risk chemicals in British rivers, publications related to their environmental risk varied between 7,531 for lead to only 2 for the anionic surfactant alcohol ethoxysulfates in the period 2015 to 2019. This area of science is prone to the bandwagon effect, by which many papers only demonstrate what we already know. Did we, for example, need more than 250 papers to tell us that ethanol estradiol poses a risk to fish? Everything we need to know to protect the environment was communicated in the first half a dozen papers. A current trend is this desire to search for increasingly more subtle effects, such as the expression of one or a few genes being altered, when the consequences of those effects are entirely unknown. Risk assessments are falling further behind, and scientists tend to stay in their silos. Thorough risk assessment is costly and may require decades of research. Given the range of species and a number of endpoints that could be examined, it seems certain that we will never catch up by using traditional approaches. If this assertion is correct, then persevering with the current testing strategy does not seem appropriate. Ethical objections to the use of animals, particularly vertebrates, in tests are increasing, yet we continue to add more tests to the Organization of Economic Cooperation and Development battery of accepted ecotoxicity tests. Efforts to rethink how the environmental risks of a chemical can be assessed with an expanded role for predictive modeling of harmful properties are ongoing, but regulators seem cautious about relying on such information. The study of chemicals and the environment appears to revolve largely around two disciplines of exotoxicology and environmental chemistry. In their publications, exotoxicologists commonly state that effects were observed at environmentally relevant concentrations, whereas environmental chemists are often tempted to assert that their highest measured concentrations exceeded reported effect or toxic concentrations. Such statements imply that chemicals are harming the environment, possibly to a serious extent, on a daily basis. However, it's unclear, based on the evidence of ecotoxicology and environmental chemistry alone, whether we are exaggerating the dangers and thus overregulating or, alternatively, underestimating risks, as has been proposed for mixture effects, and thus failing to protect. Additionally, a third community of scientists, ecologists, has much to offer, in theory, in assessing chemical impacts on wildlife. The presence of long-term wildlife monitoring is vital for such research, but we see surprisingly few examples of collaboration between ecologists, ecotoxicologists, and environmental chemists. Ecologists have highlighted alarming declines in some wildlife populations, and despite many confounding variables, long-term ecological data can be extremely compelling toward establishing a link between competing arguments. Outlook. Adapting to the immensely difficult societal and environmental challenges of tomorrow will undoubtedly require new chemicals and chemical solutions. The production of chemicals, their diversity, and their use around the world has never been greater. Our ability to manage the risks is finely balanced, with reasons to be both pessimistic and optimistic. Unfortunately, the sheer volume of chemicals on the market, and presumably also entering the market, currently outpaces our ability to assess the risks. Although there are no guarantees, our past knowledge combined with in silico modeling of hazards will be beneficial in gauging relative risk. Provided that long-term wildlife monitoring efforts are maintained, particularly in areas with the greatest chemical exposure, we may have some confidence that our use of chemicals is sustainable. We continue now with an article from HarvardPolitics.com, The Myth of Algae Biofuels. This is by Joseph Winters and was posted on January 26, 2020. In 2017, ExxonMobil announced an intriguing energy innovation. In partnership with biotech company Synthetic Genomics, it had used CRISPR gene editing technology to produce a strain of algae that ExxonMobil claimed could pave the way toward a sustainable future and reduce the risk of climate change. Ever since then, the company has used numerous social media platforms, including Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter, to share its miniature science video campaign, promoting the idea that algae could fuel the trucks, ships, and planes of tomorrow. Algae biofuels, a form of renewable energy that converts sea-growing algae into liquid fuel, have been intensely studied since the oil crisis of the 1970s. Since then, most fossil fuel companies have pursued algae biofuel research ventures, fiddling with production processes to make these sea vegetables a viable alternative energy. In recent years, however, many of these companies have abandoned their algae biofuel partnerships and projects due to the biological and economic limitations of this work. ExxonMobil remains largely alone in maintaining that a clean energy future powered by algae biofuels is just around the corner. However, this is the same company that not too long ago was actively discrediting legitimate climate science. Since the 1960s, ExxonMobil has known from its in-house climate scientists and climate modeling program that climate change is human-caused and driven by fossil fuel use. It subsequently conducted one of the most sophisticated and most successful disinformation campaigns ever, on par with the tobacco industry's campaign to discredit links between smoking and lung cancer. Considering this problematic history of obfuscating climate science, combined with the disappointing outcomes of algae biofuel research, ExxonMobil's efforts to promote algae biofuels as a climate solution seems disingenuous, more of a public relations strategy than a serious effort to mitigate climate change. The lost promise of algae biofuel innovation. Many industry projections for algae biofuels remain highly optimistic. The algae company Algatech, for instance, states that algae biofuels are 100% beneficial to the people and the planet. This inflated enthusiasm has been prevalent since the early days of algae research. Beginning with the launch of the U.S.-funded Aquatic Species Program in the 1970s, millions of dollars in public and private funds have been directed toward algae research. The Department of Energy has been a major driver of algae research since 2007, with significant funding also coming from the U.S. Air Force, the Department of Defense, the National Science Foundation, and the Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency. The algae that has received the most attention is known as microalgae, mostly single-celled photosynthetic organisms that live on the water surface. Microalgae are one of the most abundant and important organisms on the planet. Numbering some 7,000 species, microalgae play an outsized role in balancing marine ecosystems and regulating global nutrient cycles. To transform these tiny plants into fuel, researchers typically grow microalgae in large open ponds or in enclosed photobioreactors, although at scale, they would likely need to be grown in the open air. Scientists harvest the algae, break down the plant's cell walls using a chemical solvent, and then extract their inner lipids, proteins, and carbs, which undergo a final processing step that turns them into biofuel. Most research funding has been shuttled into improving these processes, minimizing inputs, and maximizing outputs, with the aim of making large-scale algae production commercially viable. ExxonMobil claimed to have made a big step toward this goal in 2017. Working with biotech company Synthetic Genomics, which ExxonMobil helped to found in 2009, ExxonMobil announced that it had created a genetically modified strain of microalgae that could produce double the lipids without significantly inhibiting growth. This innovation could, theoretically, allow the company to afford an enormous scale-up of its biofuel production. In fact, ExxonMobil was confident enough in its breakthrough that it claimed gene editing could allow the production of a startling 10,000 barrels of algae biofuel per day by 2025. Yet, while ExxonMobil celebrates these supposed breakthroughs in genetic engineering, other energy companies have long since given up on algae biofuels. In 2012, Shell had ended its algae biofuel research and development program. News had dried up of BP's $10 million deal with bioscience firm Martek and Chevron's five-year partnership with the government-funded National Renewable Energy Laboratory had produced no significant breakthroughs. By early 2018, Chevron's website had gone from promising that algae biofuel development was still in the research stage to openly admitting its work was unsuccessful. Algae companies around the world have also announced intentions to shift or diversify their research aims, usually to producing algae for food or nutritional supplements. For example, Alginol shifted to carbon capture and freshwater creation in 2015, and Chevron-backed Solazyme announced in 2016 that it would discontinue its biofuels program altogether. It seems that only ExxonMobil retains the dizzied excitement over algae biofuels of decades past. Although the company has not promoted many specific breakthroughs in its algae biofuel research since 2017, ExxonMobil's social media presence suggests continued optimism for the future of this renewable energy. If you look at ExxonMobil's Facebook or Instagram, you'd think that algae is all they're thinking about all the time, Zoya Thierstein, a reporter for Grist, told HPR. Yet, according to Thierstein, the company seems uneager to actually communicate this work to the mainstream media. When you call their offices, there's no algae unit, there's no gaggle of scientists working on this. Their major product is still oil. When Thierstein called the company, none of the three representatives she spoke with had any idea what she was referring to when she asked about algae biofuels. The costs of continued investment. Despite energy optimism, decades of research seem to have converged upon a disappointing reality. The economic and biological limitations of algae make it an unrealistic fuel alternative for the future. It requires too much fertilizer, too much water, and too much energy to produce at scale. To grow enough algae to meet 5% of the U.S. transportation sector's energy demand would require exorbitant fertilizer inputs of up to 107% of the country's nitrogen use and half of its phosphorus. And the industrial processes need to actually convert algae into fuel could actually cause a net energy loss. Algae could take up to 53% more energy to produce than it would offer as biofuel. With these considerations in mind, think tanks and research bodies around the world are advising governments against intensifying algae biofuel research, especially when funding could compete with more promising research into renewables like solar and wind. N-Algae, an EU-funded coalition of 19 research bodies, concluded in 2015 that it was highly unlikely that microalgae would play a large role in Europe's sustainable energy future. Similarly, in 2017, The International Energy Agency reiterated that algae was not foreseen to be economically viable in the near to intermediate term. Yet, as these predictions proliferate, ExxonMobil remains convinced that, with the help of some genetically engineered traits, algae production can be made profitable at scale, overcoming the biological limitations that have frustrated previous efforts. These genetic modifications introduce new reasons for caution, specifically the troubling possibility that genetically engineered algae strains could easily escape into the environment. At present, many researchers grow their algae in indoor enclosures, but to scale them up would likely require growing algae in open-air systems where the potential for escape increases exponentially. You only need one bird to get it on its feet and fly off, explained Kevin Flynn, a top algae researcher at Swansea University, in an interview with the HPR. That single bird could take algae wherever it landed, accidentally helping to establish algae colonies, potentially hundreds of miles from the original site. Flynn's research finds that once in nature, it would be alarmingly easy for microalgae to spread around the planet, where it could overwhelm native species, particularly if the algae had specifically engineered traits to help them outcompete with other wildlife. The spread of genetically modified microalgae would be impossible to halt, Flynn warned in a 2012 study. Scientists can only guess how genetically engineered algae would behave in nature, but many experts have warned of disastrous consequences. Harmful algae blooms could cause massive fish kills and death to marine birds and mammals, as well as illness or even death to humans, or create oxygen-depleted oceanic dead zones where most life simply cannot exist. Horizontal gene transfer, whereby microalgae transfer genes asexually, take up naked DNA in the environment, pose another concern. By this process, genetically engineered algae could confer their own DNA to wild algae. Because these genes are broadly growth-enhancing, they could proliferate rapidly, drastically increasing the risk of harmful algae blooms. Most researchers do not question whether microalgae would find its way into the wild. Rather, they operate under the assumption that it would escape. There is a chance that international contamination could be benign. But according to Flynn, there is an equally higher, if not much higher, chance that it could devastate ecosystems. He compares an algae escape scenario to the Exxon Valdez oil spill. With only algae's ability to propagate rapidly, this could be much, much worse. Unlike a relatively localized oil spill, if a dangerous algae species were released into the wild, even well-funded long-term cleanup efforts could prove futile. A shift toward real climate solutions. Inefficient biology, economics, and ecological hazards undermine ExxonMobil's insistence that commercially viable algae biofuels are just over the horizon. Even ExxonMobil's former CEO, Rex Tillerson, has acknowledged that a future powered by algae biofuels is not close at hand, saying in 2013 that it could take 25 years to develop a commercially viable product. The myth of this future promise is perhaps algae biofuels' most pernicious future. They siphon attention and resources away from more realistic climate solutions. Algae biofuels distract us from more promising resources like solar and wind. Dana Perls, senior food and agriculture campaigner for Friends of the Earth, told the HPR. For Perls, each dollar invested in algae biofuel research represents funding that could have helped install more promising solar or wind infrastructure. However, even if algae biofuels are a dead end and a dangerous distraction in terms of climate solutions, they have immense value as a marketing tool. ExxonMobil's algae biofuel ad campaign paints it as a green company, creating the outward impression that environmentalism is one of its core concerns. This green veneer helps diminish public pressure to act more aggressively on climate change. It keeps people stringing along, thinking we're almost there, Rachel Smolker, co-director of Biofuel Watch, told the HPR. If they believe that there is a meaningful push for more algae biofuel research and that full-scale deployment is just around the corner, people may be more complacent about demanding immediate change in companies' practices and government policy. Furthermore, ExxonMobil's decades-long history of sowing climate misinformation raises serious questions about its motivations in promoting algae biofuels as a climate solution. ExxonMobil stands to gain from climate delayism. The longer the company can impede a transition to renewable energies, the longer it can continue to profit off of an economy dependent on fossil fuels. As climate skepticism becomes less common, climate distraction, focusing on unrealistic and not yet deployable green technology, may work in similar ways, breeding a comparable complacency around the climate inaction. And that brings us to the end of today's edition of Touching the Future. I'm your SunSounds volunteer, Chip Hawbrook. If you missed a program on SunSounds, you can listen to it whenever you want by getting it on demand. Go to sunsounds.org and click Broadcast Info and Audio.